This is the Backlog Battle Podcast, episode 222.
Shadowboxing.
Welcome to another episode of the Backlog Battle Podcast. This is Alex.
And this is Daniel.
What's going on, man?
Dude, I have to reveal my inner weeb real quick.
Okay.
I've been watching an anime called Megalobox.
That is a weird title. And also two words that shouldn't be mixed together, I don't think.
Yeah, it's weird, but it's fucking awesome. So, have you ever heard of Ashita no Joe?
I have heard and maybe even seen the words together, but I don't really recall what it is.
Okay, so Ashita no Joe, I've only seen like one episode of it, but it is an old school anime. It came out 50 years ago.
Ooh.
And it's a boxing anime. And it's considered a legendary classic. Like, this is basically like, when people talk about, like, the holy grails of anime, this is one of them. This is one of the the revered, like, you know, you look back on it, it's like, this is like Lawrence of Arabia, like, of anime, you know, but it's a boxing anime. Like, it's considered, like, a, you know, this classic.
Okay.
And the reason I bring it up is because Megalobox is a new show that is kind of like celebrating the 50th anniversary of Ashita no Joe. It doesn't have a direct relation to it or anything like that, but it's more like a celebration of the 50th anniversary with this new show that carries the spirit of Ashita no Joe.
Okay.
And unlike Ashita no Joe, which was like, I think it was like 150 episodes or something like that.
Jesus.
Megalobox is only going to be 12.
Okay.
Now, the one thing about Megalobox that kind of made me a little wary about it at first, it's not just a typical boxing anime. There's got to be a fucking gimmick.
Mm-hmm.
And the gimmick in this one is that it takes place, you know, sometime in the future. It's a little ambiguous about it, but the boxing matches has dudes wearing things called gears, and there are these mechanical enhancements that they put on their arms to make their punches more deadlier.
So this is basically ARMS, as in the video game.
I didn't even connect those dots, but you're right. Yes. Mm-hmm. But they're not stretchy. So
okay. Okay.
There's no stretchy arms here. It's more like, you know, mechanical enhancements.
Gotcha.
And so far, I believe there's only 5 episodes, and they are awesome. I'm already like hotly anticipating whenever the next episode drops. This show is awesome, and the last two episodes in particular, episodes 4 and 5, felt like kind of like a self-contained arc in a way.
Wow!
And it focused primarily on the other opponent that the main character was fighting, and he was dealing with like post-traumatic stress disorder because he fought in a war, and he took those emotions into the ring, and the effects that it had on him were such that like he would beat his opponents mercilessly, and you know, it's just like really, really heavy stuff. And you know, another thing that's like really cool about the show is the aesthetic. This show looks and feels like it came out in like the late 90s or like the early 2000s. I think they even intentionally blur the image just a little bit to give it that kind of like 90s feel to it. The colors are also more muted. It's not as, because like a lot of current anime look very, very like stylized, mm-hmm. super, super clean, high contrast. And this show feels dirty. It feels gritty. So if anything I just said interests you just a little bit, it's airing right now on Crunchyroll. So I strongly recommend it. It's a really good show. It's awesome stuff.
So, I mean, we're not shilling here, just to be clear.
No.
How much?
No, we're not endorsed by Crunchyroll, although, you know, if Crunchyroll wants to, I don't think we'll say
Okay. Like, how much is a Crunchyroll subscription?
I think it depends. You can, like, pay monthly or pay every 3 months. That's what I do. I pay every, like, 3 months, and that's like $20.
Total for 3 months?
3 months is $20.
Okay, so, wow, that's actually not bad, because, like, the WWE Network subscription is, like, $10 a month and stuff. That's pretty pricey.
Yeah, and I think if you want to do, like, yearly, it's, like, $60 or something
like
that.
Yeah, it's probably even cheaper. Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah. Okay, well, it's funny you mentioned that, because I think I told you about this anime/manga called Hajime no Ippo, right?
Oh, I know about Ippo. I've never seen it. I've never seen it, but I do know of it. And actually, when a lot of people talk about boxing anime, people will often compare Ippo and Ashita no Joe and say, like, Ippo is more like Rocky, while Ashita no Joe is closer to Raging Bull, which is one of my favorite movies. Raging Bull is fucking, you know, top-tier Scorsese.
Right. And yeah, Ippo is actually really, really good. Like, I mean, that's the anime that I watched, and, you know, like, boxing anime that I watched and stuff. And certainly, like, the anime you're mentioning is, like, really freaking cool. But, like, Ippo is suffering from this weird situation right now in anime where it's like, okay, you know, our animated series is catching up on the manga, and so therefore we have to freaking stop making them. So it caused essentially what happened was they had like the series going on for a long time and then caught up with the manga at the time, and then they stopped completely. And I think I want to say it took them like 3 or 4 years or even maybe more years later, and then they made like a 12 or 13 episode arc and then completely gone again, which I'm like, guys, like, this is not, you know, like, this is not how you do this. This is ridiculous. Now,
you know what the alternative is? Fucking Naruto had 100 episodes of filler, 100 episodes that had nothing to do with anything. Yeah. So that's your alternative.
Yeah, actually, it's funny. My wife actually said, like, yeah, like, how do you expect people to keep interest on your show, you know, if your show just disappears and then comes back? This isn't like, you know, the UK where they could sustain, like, a freaking, what is it, like, 30-year, like, show and only, 10-year show and only have 33 episodes between those 10 years, you know, which, by the way, that's a thing that happens in Europe, by the way. I don't know if you know that.
I had no idea.
So, okay, so a more modern example of this, Daniel, is the Sherlock series with Benedict Cumberbatch. There are 4 seasons, maybe 5, of that show, and only 2 or 3 episodes each season. But each episode is about 1 hour to 2 hours long. But still, that's like what? Like less than 6 episodes or something? Like, technically, or, you know, it's weird, man. Like, UK is weird. So
yeah, the only UK show I watch is Doctor Who, although I fell off Doctor Who a while ago.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well,
when they switched between what's his name, Davies, something Davies was the writer of the Christopher Eccleston arc, the David Tennant arcs, those were awesome. But then when it switched over to Matt Smith, they switched to a different writer named Stephen Moffat, who had written some really good one-off episodes. But when he took over as the writer, I felt like the general quality of the writing had dropped. So it kind of felt to me like, oh, he's really good in small spurts, you know, but like him like taking over, I just really did not like the direction he took the show in.
That's unfortunate. You know, lame when, you know, like a writer taking over and stuff just couldn't pull the potential out of the show. That's really a bummer and stuff.
That's not to say like everything he did was like terrible or anything. No. You know, there was some good stuff with the Matt Smith arc, but it felt like it lost the whimsy. Like there was like a certain, like, je ne sais quoi, a certain charm that was just missing. Like, it was more dour, and the attempts to be quirky and fun came off a little more hollow.
Yeah, I mean, that's why, like, in the States and stuff, you generally have a committee that makes sure that the story arcs for all the characters and the story itself kind of follow a very specific path, and not one writer is responsible for, you know, kind of like the journey of that path, you know what I mean? And they hire different writers to deal with different episodes, and of course different directors as well. So, you know, that's, to me, like, that's actually pretty brilliant and stuff. And I've watched enough modern comedies on TV these days that they do a really good job. The difference is almost imperceptible when it comes to the feel and the mood. I almost said food, which I tried to mix feel and mood. I'm like, no, that doesn't work that way.
Unless you're talking about Hannibal.
That's canceled. I'm sad about that. Really?
I saw the first two seasons. I didn't see season three, but the first two seasons were pretty awesome.
It's been canceled, unfortunately. I think after season three, they actually faltered quite a bit. I think
season three wasn't that good.
Yeah, it faltered quite a bit. That's all I heard. I know.
I loved season two. Like, season one was cool, and then for me, season two was like they took it to another level. This was awesome.
Oh yeah, both of those are really awesome. But season three, like, I watched the first couple of episodes, and I'm like, there's something off about this. Like, this really doesn't feel right. You know, and it's kind of sad.
Well, now you know how I felt when they switched to Matt Smith.
Well, there you go. I guess you're right about that.
Because another thing with, not to harp on Doctor Who too much, but I also wanted to get this across, like, because with Matt Smith, another thing that I thought was really fucking weird was that in previous seasons, the Doctor was just some fucking weirdo that goes on space adventures. And then with Matt Smith, for whatever reason, the writer decided to make the Doctor, like, the most fucking important and most, like, feared figure in the universe and shit. Like people, like, whisper his name in the shadows. Like, and I was just like, what the fuck is this? Like,
wow.
This is, you've changed the context of the characters so severely. Like, he's literally just a weirdo that just goes around on goofy adventures. And yeah, he saves people and stuff, and people are, like, appreciative of him. But, like, he's not this, like, mythical figure that was suddenly transformed into. Like, he was just dumb. It was bad.
Yeah, this sounds like the midichlorian problem in, like, the prequel Star Wars movies.
Oh, don't bring up that cursed word, man.
I had to in this case. But, man. But going back to anime, though, over the weekend, my wife and I actually really got into One Punch Man.
I saw you tweet about that, and I was just like, oh, I only saw the first couple episodes of that, but I really dug it. I should go back to it.
Oh my god, we binged it in one day, dude. Like, we finished the entire season. We're like, this is ridiculous. I want to see what happens to Saitama at the end. And then,
season two is already announced.
I heard, and the funny thing is, prior to this week, I had actually been searching when the second season was going to be debuted, and as early as, like, 2015-ish or 2016, people were saying, like, oh yeah, season two is going to debut in 2016 and stuff, like, in August, and of course, you know, 2 years later, we're still thinking about when season two is coming out, so until it comes out, I'm just going to, you know, check out other animes and audiobooks and all that stuff.
Like Megalobox.
There you go. I mean, we can definitely check that out and stuff, but I don't know. We'll have to figure out the budget because, you know, got WWE Network, you got Netflix, your Crunchyroll, well, and it's like, oh.
Lucky for you, as a Crunchyroll member, I have, like, a number of 48-hour guest passes.
Jesus.
So I can let you... I can just, like, all you need is an account, and I can just send you the guest pass, and you'll have full access for, like, 2 days.
Okay, that's a lot of pressure.
And don't worry, I have multiple of them, so, like, it's more like you have, like, 8 days.
Oh, okay, I see what you... Okay, I get it now. I thought this was one of those things where it's like, all right, boom, 48 hours is done. Do you want to subscribe? Like, you can't, like, add on to that. It's not like a, like, you know, it's not like a kind of like a...
When you use the guest...
Bank.
when your guest pass expires, just hit me up and hit me up again and just be like, hey Shintai, the guest pass expired, and I'm like, okay, cool, here's another one.
Okay, sure.
So I have a bunch of them.
I mean, I'll call you Daniel, of course, because Shintai is a weeaboo name, but
yes, but you know, some people know me as that. Some people, you know, prefer to call me that. Like, I actually told a friend of mine, like, and explained that, like, because she saw my email, and my email is Dan the Man Oscar, and I explained, like, oh, you know, Daniel's my middle name, Oscar's my first name, and hence the email. And she's like, oh, that's cool, I'm still going to call you Shintai, though.
Have you considered just setting up a Shintai Gmail that just forwards to Dan the Man? It's kind of ridiculous.
No.
I mean, it's free. Might as well. I'm thinking, you know, it's kind of silly, but, you know.
Yeah, it's whatever.
It's whatever, he says. So, yeah, like, we really liked One Punch Man, and I was really happy to see that season two is maybe coming this year. Maybe. I say maybe because we've had this conversation for about the past 2 years, and I'm just waiting for the actual show to show up. You know what I mean? So
no, yeah, I feel you. It people wait a long time for Attack on Titan season two as well, and I was just like, by the time it came out, I just didn't care anymore.
Right? Yeah, that's kind of like what my wife was saying and stuff. Is like, and also it this kind of ventured into the conversation of what's happening with the Game of Thrones right now. Now, mind you, I'm not a big fan. She's no longer a fan, but at least with Game of Thrones, like, it's far exceeded where, you know, where the books have gone right now, and they're just kind of forging their own path, you know, which is really fascinating. So, you know, kind of like the suggestion you did earlier, or, you know, like, basically, like, just noting how Naruto did it and stuff, it's like, this is another way to go about it. Like, you forge your own path, you basically create the future for that series and stuff, as opposed to having these long ass breaks where people just forget that you exist, and now you have to basically once again prove to people why you need to be paid attention to, you know.
That's what happened with Fullmetal Alchemist. So
yes,
the original Fullmetal Alchemist series back in 2003 followed the manga fairly closely for the first half of the show, and then the second half they veered off in a completely different direction. And it's funny because at the time people loved the show, but then when people figured out that it was unfaithful to the manga, it became the hip thing to hate on it, which I always thought that was stupid. It was a great show, mm-hmm. and hating on it just because it became its own thing is stupid. It's still a really good show.
Yeah.
But it is very cool, though, that after that, they created another show that was more faithful to the source material from start to finish. So, mm-hmm. you know, you got the best of both worlds.
Yeah, my wife is also talking about that show specifically, too, when they had that specific arc that wasn't about the manga and stuff, and I actually didn't know that. So, you know, it's great that you actually remembered it more than I did, but, you know, that's really cool.
I love Fullmetal Alchemist. I have, like, the whole series on Blu-ray. It's great.
Nice, nice, nice. Yeah, I think...
Not the movies, though. All the movies are terrible. Don't watch any of the movies. They're all complete shit.
Okay. All right. Yeah, it was definitely a fascinating conversation about, you know, anime catching up with manga and stuff over the weekend. So I'm kind of happy that we had this conversation. So this kind of, I don't know how I can pivot this to audiobooks, but I'm not going to force it to pivot to audiobooks. Instead, I'm actually going to forcibly pivot this to Yakuza, because another thing that I noticed, and I don't know if you saw this tweet, was I tweeted over the weekend that I didn't know that in Yakuza 5, because I'd actually, like, restart Yakuza 5 for some unknown reason, that you can read the first volumes of a lot of the comics in the convenience stores. Like, you know, I tweeted a photo of literally, like, the first issue of Attack on Titan, and it's all in Japanese, of course, but you can read the entire thing, like, from beginning to end, like, for that first story. And I was like, whoa, what the hell? And they also had Fairy Tail. They also had Ghost in a Shell. And I was just and Hajime no Ippo was in it. I was like, holy fuck. Like, I didn't know that this was here. Like, that this was actually freaking, you know, readable and stuff. I mean,
it's cool, but it's in Japanese, so.
Yeah, I mean, there's that. That's why I added the caveat of, like, well, if you know Japanese, this is fucking cool, but chances are, if you are, and you know Japanese, and you live in Japan, you probably have already read this before, right? You know, that sort of situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a bummer for us, but, yeah. You know. It's still a neat thing to throw in. The equivalent for us would be like if you were playing GTA and you could pick up like X-Men Volume 1 or something.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That would have been freaking cool. Actually, on a interesting side note, too, like I told you just now that I restarted Yakuza 5. So when I actually started Yakuza 5, like from the very beginning, thanks to a, you know, premium new game plus and stuff, it was interesting because I literally started the game, Daniel, and then I went to make dinner. Because I don't know if you guys out there have ever played Yakuza 5, but that is one of the longest intros, even longer than Persona 4, I have ever played, quote-unquote, in a video game. That shit just keeps going and going like crazy. So
yeah, I actually don't remember the intro being quite that long, but I don't, you know, I trust you. Like I
yeah, so I'll give you the overview of what happens. So basically it starts off in Fukuoka, right? And then of course there's Daigo and then Madarame and stuff, not to be confused with Madarame from Persona 5. That's a different one. And then there's this scene where Daigo leaves and stuff, that whole scene, and then does this taxi cab ride where he just talks to himself. He leaves. Kiryu basically is revealed to be the taxi cab driver, goes back to the cab office and says, like, oh, yeah, I messed up by taking this guy out of line and, like, the taxi cab line. And then finally you gain control of Kiryu. That whole scene, I think, lasts for about 30 minutes or 40, maybe, because it's all literally like just stuff you gotta watch up until the point where you get to the taxi cab company, and then now you have to basically buy a gift and apologize. But once that happens and stuff, you maybe get like a fight, and then you get to buy something, and you get to turn in something, and then you meet up with your boss. And then from the boss onwards, that's another 30 minutes where you have to literally watch something, because you not only like do that, you go to like a bar first. No. You go to eat first, and then you go to like a ramen place. Then you go to a cabaret, and then, you know, oh man, is this ringing a bell to you, by the way?
Yes, the memories are starting to come back.
Okay, thank you. Because I was like, this is within the span of maybe a little bit of a little bit under an hour, this whole process. And my wife was like, wow, this is taking a while to get started. And I'm like, yep, welcome to Yakuza 5. There you go. That's the thing that happens in this game.
You know what else is another thing that happens in that game?
What?
Yume. Which is the Japanese word for dream.
Yes.
I want to see someone compile the amount of times the word dream is said in that game.
Oof.
It is so, like, ham-fisted, and it is so, like, you know, like, in Yakuza 6, it's pretty obvious to a certain extent that the theme is family. But the actual word family is probably only said like a handful of times. In Yakuza 5, holy shit, everyone is going on about their fucking dreams. Mm-hmm. It's my dream to become an idol. It's my dream that Haruka, you know, fulfills her dream. It's my dream to eat this bowl of ramen. Like, Jesus Christ.
You know, one of the only kind of driving forces why I actually wanted to restart Yakuza 5 is I wanted to know how you got to making ramen at that ramen joint. Because I actually really enjoyed the mini game, and I was like, you know what? Fuck this. I'm not going to go there in a premium new adventure. Why would I do that? I'll just go and freaking restart the game. And then, of course, I discovered how long the game takes to start, and then I'm like, I'm in a different place than I was back when this game launched. Maybe I'm just going to use my, you know, premium adventure and go over there and make some ramen. How about that? Yeah.
I'm so conflicted about Yakuza 5 because on one hand, content-wise, it might just be the best game. There's so much to do. I think there's more things to do in Yakuza 5 than any other game in the series.
Yes.
You can go hunting, the taxi driving, the idle stuff, the baseball minigame is super in-depth. Like, so many things to do, and it's all, like, good, high-quality stuff. And it's, you know, and up to that point in the series, the combat's the best it's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
But the writing is the worst. It is the worst writing in the entire fucking series. But, like, it's not even close. Like, and I thought 3 was kind of like, you know, it had a pretty slow start, you know, but eventually gets good. But, like, wow, that stuff, all the stuff in Okinawa really drags its heels. Or even, like, 4, even though 4 is, like, super entertaining, it's also, like, super dumb, especially in the second half. You know, bunch of lousy revelations for, you know, shock value, like, plot twists. But, like, Yakuza 5 is just like, holy shit, what happened? This is just bad. Like,
yeah, and that's kind of the thing that I wanted to experience again, in a way, for better or for worse. That's why I decided to start a new game plus. Because, I mean, I did like it back when it got released. And, you know, I had said at one point that it even probably should have ranked like one of my top fives of that year. Unfortunately, of course, it's one of those games that came out in December, which I'm like, why the fuck would you do that and pretty much murder any chance of getting that game released or any attention for that matter. But, you know, it is what it is. I don't know, was it released in December? Am I remembering this correctly?
I'm not really sure, especially since for me, like, when I first downloaded it, I only played it for a bit and then I put it down and I came back to it like way, way later.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, for me, I don't remember exactly when it came out.
So the game got released on December 8th, 2015. That's pretty late, I'd say.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's really sad because it is a really good game, and in my opinion, like, at the time, at least. Especially since that's the year when The Witcher 3 came out, right? Maybe that's the reason why I was okay with how lengthy it is, because The Witcher 3 came out around the same time, which is also lengthy, of course. But, you know, I feel like 5 has to have something noteworthy in the story that, you know, that I might be missing. Because I'm also saying this with the context of I don't really quite remember all of Yakuza 5 to make that assumption and to make that assertion. So I want to remind myself of that, because at the very least, I know that Yakuza 4 was really entertaining because of, Akihiko, which, you know, man, his story is the best.
You mean Akiyama.
Akiyama. Thank you. Not the Persona 3 character. Yeah, all these freaking names, man.
I totally feel you on that. It really bothers me because when I'm playing Yakuza 6, like, they'll name drop a character, and it's always like, fuck, who is that? Who are they talking about? Yeah. Like,
which bald guy is this?
Yeah, because it's like, you know, because, you know, obviously Japanese is not our native language, so it's harder for us to remember and keep track of all these names.
At least they didn't decide to change the names to more Americanized names. They couldn't. I remember the 90s when they were rampant when it came to that. So,
I will say in Yakuza 5's defense that I felt that the arcs with Shimada, who was the baseball guy, and Haruka during her idol phase were actually some of the best parts story-wise.
Really?
And the reason I say that, though, it's because they're completely divorced from the main plot.
That's true. I mean, to me, Haruka's was probably one of my favorite, probably even my favorite of the whole game, actually.
Yeah, her part is really good.
As far as, like, the baseball guy is concerned, I didn't really, you know, latch on to him that much. Like, I thought that...
Oh, really? I liked him a lot.
I feel like the story they're trying to tell was pretty cool, but like at the same time, like, even though Haruka's storyline is divorced from the main story, I mean, she's still tangentially connected to what's going on, you know, in some way.
Well, okay, yes, but technically his is as well. And that's actually my biggest issue, where they actually work better as standalone stories. And the parts where they try to like connect them to the main plot comes across as really messy and makes the plot of the game just come across as that much more convoluted and messy. And
I think at that point, that's just the fault of the, you know, how they brought it all together, right? Like, you know, I think the vision of this game was like, hey, let's make fucking really dramatically different cities, right? And then just like, let's just fucking cram them together, like, in this one game, and then let's figure out the story. You know, like,
and they just could not do it.
Yeah, and we've read a lot of audiobooks, you know, about game design and video games in general, where we've pretty much can come to the conclusion that story is not actually the most important thing in video games, especially when people are making them. Yeah.
Well, so I think what a lot of people don't seem to understand about video game development is that what ends up happening a lot of the time, and I'm pretty sure you can confirm this, is the assets for the games are created first, and then it's the writer's job to interpret it and then make sense out of it.
I think that's actually an astute assessment. I think, to be clear, assets can mean a whole bunch of things in your parlance, right? Like level design, the actual 3D models and texturing and stuff. Whereas sometimes, like, what people do when they're prototyping their games is they do a white box or gray box testing. And what that is it's basically just like placeholder crap. And then once they know that they want to commit to a specific kind of artwork, that's when they start building out, like, you know, the 3D models, the 3D characters, the animations and stuff like that, you know. And then what's going to replace the gray box stuff, and they're literally gray boxes and stuff, like just environments filled with gray shit, no, like with a gray texture, that's when they'll do the artwork. Like they'll create the environments, make it pretty and stuff, but the gray boxes where they used to be before, that's the collision. So anyways, that's a little bit more nerdy than what you guys were probably expecting.
Sure, but to give like a quick explanation of what I'm talking about, though, like here's an example. Let's say you have this scenario and you have like this unique area and a unique boss fight, but the boss fight may actually be a character that you're familiar with in the game, but the developers already put in the time and effort to create the boss fight and this area for the boss fight. And you as the, like, let, and think about it like this, like, let's say you're the writer and you've already had an idea of what this character is like. And then all of a sudden this character's got to be a boss. And you're like, what the fuck? Like, just put yourself in that position. And it may make sense as to when you look back on certain games. It's like, you know, why was this character suddenly a boss fight? Like, that doesn't make sense. That's why. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that happen. And then the writer has to just be like, what the fuck? How do I make sense out of this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's really crazy to think how much narrative affects, you know, like our experience with games these days, right? Like if you remember about a decade or so ago, you know, narrative outside of RPGs and stuff wasn't really something people thought about, right? Like, you know, I remember playing Call of Duty 2 Big Red 1, where it's literally just like, hey, World War 2, am I right? You know, and then here's World War 2 again. And then same thing with 3, which I worked on, but, you know, we'll not get into that. And then 4, they started injecting, like, character development and stuff. And really, like, I think that, you know, when narrative suddenly became important is in the previous gen, where, you know, not only did the Japanese start kind of leaning towards that, but also the Western developers and stuff, like, to try to deliver, like, some sort of, like, narrative that kind of really enhances your experience and not necessarily the experience, you know? And it's really crazy to think that we're only really a second generation in from that realization, right? And we're already seeing some really interesting things that have transpired in terms of narrative and storytelling in games. So, yeah.
Just to be clear, that's not to say that there weren't games before that right. had great stories.
Mm-hmm.
Just that as a whole, you know, it was really the previous generation when the game industry decided, okay, you know, narrative is important.
Yeah, like everybody. We're talking about unanimously, like everybody. And like, yes, you can make the argument that indie games didn't, but I think that's more of a counterculture clash. And, you know, like that's done on purpose as opposed to, you know, like just a, you know, non-admission that narrative has no place in games. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
You know, yeah. It's like... You try to be opposite to be cool. I mean, that sounds really bad, but you get what I'm saying.
No, yeah. The rule of cool.
Yes. So, anyways, that's Yakuza 5. I'm curious about like how you're doing in Yakuza 6.
Okay, so I'm currently on chapter 12, so I'd say I'm pretty close to the end. It feels like I'm reaching the real like climax of the game. But I don't want to talk about the story too much because, you know, I don't want to spoil anyone. I want people to be able to enjoy the game.
Mm-hmm.
I will, however, talk about some side stuff that I did that was kind of amazing.
Wow.
So
okay.
I don't know if anyone saw the tweet that I put out.
Mm-hmm.
But
I did. I sure did. I fucking retweeted it. I was like, oh, fuck yeah. This is Yakuza we're talking about here.
So I did the spearfishing mini game, and there's three levels in it. I wish there were more. But when you do the third level, you fight the boss at the end, and it's a fucking shark.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this great cutscene where the shark has these glowing red eyes, and he charges at Kiryu, and Kiryu's like grabbing in, he's struggling, and then... it stops, and then the text appears, and it says, "Bloody shark." And then Kiryu punches him in the face. It's yep. amazing.
Yep.
It's glorious.
Yep. It's Yakuza for you.
Oh, man. It was something to behold.
yeah. I mean, it's pretty nuts. I mean, that whole thing, that entire storyline is pretty incredible. Like, I gotta say, like... and there's a lot of things that are really incredible about Yakuza 6 to me and stuff like that makes up for a lot of what people didn't like. And I feel like
it's a lot better written than 5. Fucking hell.
Yeah. And to me, like the way that I've seen, you know, Yakuza games is this, right? Like, I can't really truly say that I did not like my time in Yakuza 6, because a lot of people kept, you know, like actually in communities and forums and stuff say like Yakuza 6 sucked. And I'm like,
what
game did you fucking play? Like, like really?
Like, I can understand there's some elements to 6 that are disappointing when compared to like 0. Like, there's not as much content, or, you know, the combat feels like a step back, or, you know... if you're talking like in those terms, yeah, I get what you're saying, but that it sucks? Like, no.
And it's nothing.
No.
And, you know, I can't even say, like, and even to those people who said, like, well, it's not enough content compared to 0, I'm like, yeah, but comparisons to, like, Kiwami, which is, you know, which hardly had anything, in my opinion, and... you know,
well, that's because the original game hardly had anything.
Still, like, you could make the argument that you could have added some other stuff to it, right? Like, it's not just, you know, I mean, yeah, they did
add some stuff to it, but like it's because the original game was so bare bones that like even the stuff that they added, you know, seems like small potatoes compared to something like 5, where sure. 5 is just like so fucking full of content.
Right. And, you know, that game shows that they're fully capable of doing that, right? But in 6...
Yeah. But, like, yeah, Kiwami felt like a budget game, right?
Yeah, it did. Actually,
it really did. They completely reused the animations for the cutscenes from the original PS2 game. Those are not recreations. Those are literally the exact same copy-pasted animations, just with better character models.
Right. Yeah, you're right.
Like that game felt like a budget title.
Yeah, you're right.
That's why it was like $30. So, you know, can't really complain too much.
Sure.
And for a $30 game, that's a hell of a deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. But yeah, but six is here, and you're talking about the mini games and stuff. There was one other mini game, though, that you were doing other than the spearfishing that you said earlier that you actually did.
Yes, the Nugati Club, or the bar, rather.
Snack Nugati, you mean?
Snack Nugati.
Yep, Snack Nugati. The way that you say that, it's a very, like, New York accent.
Nugati. Well, there's actually... I haven't really listened to them, but there's a band called Fugazi. So I don't know.
I see.
The name reminds me of them.
Okay.
So, but yeah, this is like a string of sub stories essentially, and it's one of my favorite parts of the game because you come in this bar, and at first, you know, there's only really like one guy that will be willing to talk to you, and the bartender, she's really cool. It kind of makes me wonder, though, why are all the female bartenders called mamas?
Man, they actually talked about this in the stream, like in the live stream and stuff. It's, I actually had completely forgotten, but when I lived in Asia and stuff, like, we always, my family would always call, like, bartenders mama-san. And I never understood why. I think it's just like some sort of parlance and stuff, like, you know, like in Japan. Because I don't know if you remember this, but in Persona 5, they also have a mama-san too.
Really?
Yeah. Okay, so do you know, wait, let's backtrack.
I've done all the social links. I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, remember like where you meet the reporter lady?
Yeah, Oya.
Yeah, sure. Her, the bartender is called Mama-san.
I don't remember that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But anyways, getting back to it. So, this is one of my favorite sub-stories because it's, like I said, when you first start, no one really wants to talk to you. You have to, like, build up your friendships with these people. And the more that you keep coming back and, you know, you keep interacting with everyone, the more people are willing to talk to you. And then eventually they start revealing their problems, and then you help them with their problems, because of course you do, because you're fucking Kazuma Kiryu,
yep,
who has to help everyone with all of their problems, because he is a good boy. He is a good boy.
Okay.
He's the goodest of boys, and, you know, everyone has, like, their own little issues, and some of them are like, a little... silly, like one guy doesn't want to use the karaoke machine because he's just so adverse to technology. But then once you convince him, he gets a smartphone, and then he's like, hey, why is there no Wi-Fi in the bar? Come on.
Yep.
And then by the end, you know, you feel like you've gotten to know all the characters and you've helped them out with all their problems, and you become the king of Nugati.
Yep. Yeah. I really like that mini game and stuff. I call it a mini game, but it's more like really like a collection of side stories. It's also the side story that kind of forced me to play, you know, like darts with Mama-san. So I was like, okay, you know, I'll do that. And maybe I'll sing karaoke too, so I could build some relationship with her and stuff. So it was a really cool thing. And, you know, I feel like that mini game felt like it belonged in Yakuza 6. Like, if they had introduced this in any other Yakuza game earlier, I felt like it might have felt out of place. Because, you know, think about what you said, that this is all about family, right? Like, this game's all about family. In a way, you're kind of creating and meeting this family, like, in Snack Nugati, and you're building a relationship with everybody there, you know? So you are part of their family. You become part of their family at the end of the story. And I thought that that was actually... I mean, even to the point that the bartender is named Mama-san, right? Like, I mean, it's...
Yeah.
You know, it's...
She kind of does feel like the mother of the group.
Right. Yeah. And that's kind of the thing there and stuff. I feel like it's kind of, like, really indicative of... you know, the thematics of the game.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely agree with you. It felt so appropriate for what the game is trying to get across to the player in terms of thematics. Mm. Absolutely.
Yeah, I find it funny still that even though you know name of the game is Yakuza 6, the Song of Life, I still had no idea this game was about family. So kudos for me on that, being left in the dark on that one.
But you know,
yeah,
then you found out eventually. That's what matters. You know whether you know ahead of time or not shouldn't really affect your enjoyment of it, as long as it was done well.
No, absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. We earlier in, you know, in the show and stuff, we kind of started talking about story and stuff, and I actually wanted to jump right into talking about the book that I mentioned to you guys last week called Extra Lives: Why Video Games Matter, wrote by Tom Bissell, who also wrote The Disaster Artist, whom the movie was based off of. And I know I talked a little bit about it last week, but as a little bit of a context, this book was actually written around and released around the previous generation. So we're not talking about Uncharted 4 here, or Last of Us 2, or, you know, or an Infamous 2, or anything from, you know, this generation. So to me, it's really fascinating because...
Wait a minute. Infamous 2 did come out in the previous generation.
Second son, then, I guess.
That's what you were thinking of.
But that's pretty much like what I call it and stuff. Like, I felt like Infamous 2 is so... Like, from a look standpoint, still kind of looked a little bit like Infamous 1, and I just, you know, it attaches itself. Sorry. You know, it is.
They should have called it Infamous 3rd Son.
Or something like that. Like, why would you use... this is going to be another Xbox.
Why would you call it Infamous 2 and then have your third game called Second Son? Like, what the fuck?
This is another Xbox One situation, okay? Let's not go into this situation.
You're not even wrong.
Yeah. So, I mean, the interesting thing to me about this book is how much intensely he talks about story in games. Now, I know that you and I, and of course, like the people who have listened to us talk about these audiobooks, who hopefully you guys have realized this, you know, sometimes when people talk about stories in games, it's from like a kind of like outsider nature. And, you know, the people that we talk about are usually people who are technical in nature, right? Like the people who build the worlds, you know, in a sense that, you know, when you go to school to make video games, it's very vocational, right? Like you need to learn programming, you need to learn this, you need to learn that, but nothing really that is connected to a creative outlet. You know, like when I was studying for programming in college and stuff, I learned that in order to be a game programmer, you have to go through engineering. And I'm like, that is so opposite of what I consider games to be, which is a creative, you know, endeavor and stuff, that why isn't it going both directions? Why does it encompass art and science? This book actually approaches it from a creative writing standpoint. And that's, to me, very, very interesting, because Tom Bissell is a writer. That is his vocation. That is what he's known for, right? He is not a game designer whatsoever. Yes, he's helped write for games, but he's never written a video game. This is very similar to the book that you recommended to me, in a way, Significant Zero, but not in that kind of framing, right? The guy is not cynical. He offers a very analytical perspective from a writer's standpoint of why stories are the way that they are.
Yes, Significantly Zero was very cynical, yeah. And which is part of the reasons why I liked it.
Yeah, and the reason why I compared it to Significant Zero is because there is a time and there's a moment in Extra Lives where Tom Bissell actually starts talking about the parallels of his cocaine use, which I was like totally, you know, hit left field. Whoa. From with playing Grand Theft Auto 4. And I'm like, I understand where this is coming from, but this just kind of, I felt like I got hit in the face by like Ippo or like whoever the main character of your anime that you were watching earlier.
Oh, and Joe?
Yeah. And I'm like, what? Like, you know, and, you know, what's interesting about this too is he talks to a lot of people, right? And he kind of interviews people like, you know, Jonathan Blow is in this, Cliff Lezinski is in this. And we're not talking about like interviews, right? But more like he shadowed them and talked to them about their games and kind of you know, try to really distill and figure out why game writing is the way that it is. To a degree where this is something that you'll probably like, he actually talked to Drew Karpyshyn at BioWare when he was still there, right after, you know, shortly after Mass Effect 1 got released. So he actually talked to him at detail about books and narrative and stuff, and why sometimes, you know, like there's the dissonance between the game story and then the actual narrative story and stuff. And to me, it's fascinating. Also, fun fact, BioWare actually hires the most writers out of any development company in video games. I did not know this. Did you know that?
No, but I can't say I'm surprised.
Right. So to me, that's the most fascinating thing out of that conversation. But basically what I'm trying to say here is that if you want to read a book that really dives deep into the creative aspects of writing and how video games tackle each of the challenges and stuff, I think this is a really good book to read. I think it'll be a very easy read for anybody who's even a first-time, you know, listener for audiobooks. One of my favorite pieces, actually, of the book, and let me just tell you this, Daniel, is a part where he's kind of shadowing Cliff Bleszinski right after the creation of Gears of War. And here's the interesting thing, Daniel, and this really truly fascinated me. I'm not kidding you. And, you know, and I know this kind of sounds really weird and very timely, but I do want to kind of offer our deepest, you know, thoughts for the people who unfortunately got laid off at Boss Key. You know, I know that Radical Heights and, you know, Lawbreakers didn't work out and the studio closed down, and Cliff is totally distraught by it, like you could tell from his Twitter. I do apologize for you guys, and, you know, really, hopefully you guys get really good jobs and stuff afterwards. Tom talked to Cliff about how Gears of War was a personal project. Because if you notice, like, in Gears of War, I don't know if you've ever played it or anything.
No, I haven't.
So, in Gears of War, like, you know, even before the war happened or something, some such, like, you know, the main character's dad passed away. And it's a very weird parallel between the events of Cliffy B's personal life and growing up with the events in Gears of War. And I wish I could articulate it as best as Tom did, but there were so many instances in the story and just what was happening and the feel of the game that paralleled Cliff Bleszinski's feelings towards his personal life. And, you know, and it's kind of weird because one part of the book actually talked about how Cliff Bleszinski's father passed away while Cliff Bleszinski was playing Blaster Master, and he had never touched a game ever since, right? And then in Gears of War 2, he had asked his team to subconsciously in his mind, to design the tanks to look almost exactly like the tanks in Blaster Master. In fact, Cliff Bleszinski wasn't even acutely aware that he was doing that, only that he was told multiple times that the tanks look like the tanks from Blaster Master. And then he kind of stopped dead in his tracks and said, "Oh wow, you're absolutely right." You know? And to me, like, that's, you know, that talks to us, that speaks to me in a very interesting way, because, you know, a lot of people think that video games are just purely there to make money from and stuff, like it's for these companies to make millions of dollars and all that stuff, but there is an deeply intense personal kind of, you know, footprint that all of these guys are creating in their games, whether you're a director or an artist or a writer and stuff. And, you know, with Tom's narration and his conversations and stuff, it's really truly revealed that we leave something, they leave something indelible in these games, and, you know, that some of our best experiences, you know, sometimes offers the best stories being told, right? And I'm not saying that Gears of War's story is the best by any stretch of the imagination, but there's subtext there that you can kind of is that's almost just as interesting and probably even more interesting in this case than the actual story being told, you know? And I don't know what you think of this so far, Daniel, if I'm just talking out of my ass, but
No, you've definitely convinced me to give the book a shot.
Yeah, it's really freaking good. Like, I'm actually in the process of restarting over again, especially, like, recounting Tom's first experience playing Resident Evil 1, like, the PS1 version, and talking about, like, how his reactions to, like, how he didn't understand why the control scheme is the way that it is, or why, you know, Resident Evil was so different from the NES games he'd played before. And think about this. How would you describe to a kid who was playing NES games what Resident Evil was? Even at the time, you can't, right? Like, it's so different. But, you know, Tom does it in really exquisite detail. Like, you could literally build the scene in your brain. And, you know, a good book can do that for you. And I think, you know, Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter is literally that. And, man, I can't recommend this book, you know, enough for anybody who's wanting to read, like, a video game book out there.
Sounds awesome. I will definitely give it a shot.
Yeah. I'm curious to hear what you think, because I think that this book is right up your alley, especially since...
Sounds like it.
Yeah, it totally is. I'm like, my God, like, really does. So, but funny story, funny side note too. You know, I talked about how when you're making a video game and stuff, sometimes the personal stories, the personal events that happen in your life makes for an engaging tale, engaging effort, an engaging story or experience, what have you. And I had actually finished God of War recently.
Oh.
Yeah. And, you know, I've said before many times that Corey Barlog, the reason why he actually created God of War in this fashion is because he became a parent. You know, like, he's grown since the first, or rather the second God of War game that he made. I mean, which is his first that he directed. Anyways, this
David Jaffe did the first one.
Yeah. And, you know, and last time we talked, I was kind of a little bit wishy-washy on the game. And then I said, like, oh, it's pretty good now. And then now I'm kind of like, I wish there's more. Because I don't know about you, but, like, when I finished God of War, it felt to me like that it could be longer. And I think that's a testament to how good my experience was in the game.
I heard it had a cliffhanger ending.
It had a revelation at the end. Let's put it that way. And it is in line with the kinds of revelations that the series has had since the very first God of War on the PlayStation 2. And that's actually, I think, really important to distinguish, because, you know, Kratos is not a person that really exists in Greek mythology, right? I mean, you know, yet another son of Zeus. Okay, cool. Let's freaking do that. Like, let's freaking consider that. But, you know, like, just the way that it ended made me feel like there was something more that was going to happen. And I was just kind of like, man, is it really going to end this way? This is really freaking weird. That being said, I haven't 100% of the game, but it's a really good game that I want to kind of go back and, you know, play through and finish through everything, and actually even consider platinuming it. I know I've said that a lot, you know, like, especially with Yakuza 6 and stuff. And by no means am I not saying that, you know, one equals the other. But God of War is certainly an enjoyable game from beginning to end. And, you know, it's one of those games where I truly, like, enjoyed the battle system at the end of the day. Like, finally understanding the battle system, doing all the upgrades and stuff, and finding out what works with each. It's just as, to me at least, it was just as enjoyable as figuring out the combos in, you know, like, a stylish action game like Devil May Cry and stuff, like, you know, but in a very different way, right? Because in God of War, as I mentioned before, it's your kind of combo system is kind of a little bit, well, I don't want to say a little bit, dramatically, you know, pared down compared to previous games, right? You don't have, like, freaking pages and pages of combos anymore, but the kinds of, you know, combinations of skills that you could use range from the old school to the new school. And it, to me, like, it offered kind of like this new vision of, like, what action games could be in the future and stuff that doesn't sacrifice complexity for simplicity. And I think they actually managed to balance that out and walk like a really fine line in the middle. I mean, granted, I'm not saying this is going to replace like Bayonetta or Devil May Cry or anything like that. Not at all. But for the direction that God of War is headed towards or is wanting to head towards, I think it was a really good direction for them to go. And it also helps that the game looks fucking amazing. I mean, it just, it's...
Yeah, the graphics are pretty gorgeous.
Yeah. I will echo the biggest concern that I've talked to people about, and I feel like this is something that, unfortunately, is just something that people will notice once they play the game, so I'll just tell you now, and it's not really a spoiler. There are more boss fights with trolls than there are with, you know, like, the rest of the games in the series, the big set pieces and stuff, where I guess it is what it is, because the first God of War also had only a handful of boss fights, but still, it's like, you know, it's like, oh, there's another troll, but he's a different color, or here's two trolls now, yeah, and one's a different color, and it's like, you know,
a little too repetitive.
Yeah, a little bit. And, you know, after the fifth and sixth one, like, I almost kind of wanted another, maybe two or three more variations of quote-unquote big type characters that are like that I can fight with. I mean, I think right now they had, like, if I remember correctly, I ended with about three that I've seen, which is, you know, the trolls, the ogres, and then this, like, these elementals and stuff. But I'm like, but they don't, you know, I don't think I've ever encountered them mixed together, you know, in a situation. Maybe that would have been too crazy, but it's like, it is what it is, right? Like, that's kind of like the game that we got. And again, like, it's not really a huge knock on it, because I feel like each of the trolls actually offered, like, a different challenge. But, you know, you can kind of tell, like, what you were going to do with, you know, with those monsters and stuff once you see them. It's like, oh, okay, you're going to run up to them and then drop their big ass, like, fucking boulder on top of them and call it a day. It's another day in Kratos' day. So there you go. Yeah, but I'll tell you this though, like, the different environments are really great. You know,
it looks like an interesting world to explore.
It really is. And there are weird end game activities that you can do that get unlocked early on. Like, for example, there's these two realms that are actually challenge realms that you get to unlock even before the game is finished. And if you're ballsy enough, you could go in, but you'll probably get your ass kicked, you know?
Says you, buddy.
Just saying, like, you know, a lot of people are saying, like, you know, it's pretty challenging, but, you know, hey, you can prove me wrong whenever you get around to it.
Whenever that will be.
Yeah, probably next year or 2 years or something like that.
Oh, right? Come on, it's not going to take me that long.
When do you think you're going to get around to it?
Oh, maybe I'll get to it right after Yakuza 6.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
I am genuinely curious what you'll think of the game. And for the people who are subscribed to my YouTube channel, I'm not going to review it on there because, you know, why do you need another person to recommend God of War to you? But, Daniel, if I were to put a score on this game, it would actually be a 4 out of 5.
Not a complete 5 out of 5.
Not a complete five out of five. It's not like because it's not perfect or anything. As you guys know, the scale that I use is not a perfect score of a 5 out of 5, but it is still a very, very good game. And honestly, like, the small dings here and there that I'm not getting off of, like the troll thing, for example, like, it's, you know, it's not enough for me to, like, be like, oh, it's 3, it's a 2 or whatever. It really is a good game. Game of the generation? That's debatable. We have other games that we can consider game of the generation, but right now I think that this is probably like one of the best games of this year.
When people look back, will they remember God of War or will they remember Big Mother Truckers? I don't know.
I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, I'm just saying that because, you know, let's consider this year, right? Like, what we got so far. Far Cry 5 is kind of, you know, like, which, by the way, I have a review on the channel, did pretty well. It's the second, I think it's like the second best-selling Ubisoft game of all time, so that did pretty good, right? Monster Hunter World, which is by far the best-selling Capcom game of all time. I mean, that's pretty good, right? God of War came out, of course, and that's actually one of the most best-selling games that Sony's ever released. So even though we didn't actually get a lot of games compared to last year, Daniel, we're certainly seeing a lot of really high bar, high quality games coming out this year, you know?
You know what this reminds me of, though? Do you know who William Friedkin is?
Name sounds familiar, but I don't remember.
Okay, he's a director. He directed the movies Sorcerer, The French Connection, a few other movies. Oh, The Exorcist. That's the biggest movie he's done. And he interviewed another director by the name of Nicholas Winding Refn.
Yes, I know who that guy is.
Okay, so you know who he is. Now, I like Refn. You know, he did Drive, which I thought was good. He did Bronson, which I thought was good.
He's freaking best friends with Hideo Kojima, by the way.
I did not know.
You did not know that?
I did know that they've interacted. I didn't know that they were friends.
Dude, that's how Kojima met like Guillermo del Toro and a whole bunch of other like fucking actors. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Well, okay. So in this interview, though, Nicholas Winding Refn, he said that his movie Only God Forgives, which I thought was one of his lesser movies, I didn't dislike it, but you know, mm-hmm. I was like, okay, you know, it was okay. He thinks it's a masterpiece, and William Friedkin laughed in his face when he said this.
Wow.
But the reason he brings it up. I bring this up is because what William Friedkin said was like, you know, how long has this movie been out? Like, actually, this was in reference to Drive.
Okay.
He didn't laugh at him for Drive, but Drive came up in the conversation. And he said that Drive has only been out for 4 years. That's not even a pimple on the ass of the movie industry. Citizen Kane and 2001 A Space Odyssey came out in the 50s and the 60s, and those movies have aged like fine wine. Who's to say if people will remember Drive in that span of time?
Mm-hmm.
And that is that, you know, is why I bring it up, because who's to say in 40 years time if people will think back and remember the God of War reboot or soft reboot, whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and in the same way people would look back and think about Mario or something.
I think that's when I'm gonna bring back the story to Extra Lives, that book that I mentioned, because it is, you know, in order for us to really understand and really truly appreciate games and stuff, we need to go a bit further away from the game itself and look at the influences that drove these games to be created, right? And again, like I told the story of how, you know, Cliff Bleszinski's Gears of War is actually like kind of like a almost biographical tale of his life and stuff, especially his relationship with his parents. And, you know, and also now with God of War, it's kind of like, you know, Kratos growing up is kind of like Corey Barlog, you know, from the moment they've directed God of War 2 going all the way up to now. And it's kind of like this changed man in a way. Like it's, you know, it's, there's these kind of struggles and kind of interesting, you know, parts of the story that's being told here that right now, obviously we're taking this at face value, right? It's the events of Kratos' story that's happening. But then I feel like what makes video games truly fascinating as a medium, and actually I think all media, not just video games, but also movies and TV, is what were they thinking in a way that drove them to do this, right? Like what was their passion? Because you have to have passion in order to create something. I mean, my God, think about God of War. The same people worked on it for 5 years. 5 years, not just like a year or two. This is a 5-year commitment that is literally waking up at the ass crack of dawn every single day in LA traffic, driving about an hour and a half to Santa Monica, where it's got shit tons of traffic, by the way, coming in at 8, leaving at 10 p.m., and doing this for 5 years, maybe 5 to 6 days a week.
Oh my fucking God.
Think about that commitment. And, you know, and the commitment that these guys have put through, especially with somebody as, you know, as creative and somebody who has a clear vision as Corey Barlog, you know, framing that time frame for you guys, even you guys listening, think about that time frame and how maybe one, two, or maybe a majority of his studio told him, Corey, we can't put the camera behind Kratos. It's never going to work. And him, the one person in a 100 to 200 person company, basically like, you know, saying, no, it's going to work. It's going to be amazing. And basically like just keeping getting bombarded by people saying it's never going to work. It's never going to work. How much passion and dedication would you have before you would say, okay, fine, have it your way? You know, like not a lot of people can do that, in my opinion. Here we are, 5 years later, God of War came out to the exact specifications of like what Corey had, and it, you know, it's critically acclaimed. There's something to be said about that dedication and commitment.
I have to say, if I had to push some sort of key decision like that for a game and to stand my ground up against like what sounds like the entire company, like that's wow, that's not an easy thing to go up against, you know. That's it. I think most people would fold because you're up against so many people who think this is a bad idea. You're mm-hmm. you know, this isn't the way that it should be, and everyone is doubting you. Like that's not easy to deal with.
Mm-hmm. And in some other companies you do find democracies, right? Like, you know, there are meetings to make sure that everybody's on the same page and stuff like that. But this is different. This is one guy's vision. And he managed to literally convince the entire company eventually. Like, but it took them like what, like 3 or 4 years to basically say like, okay, we're wrong. This is actually working, right? To finally see where Corey's vision was gonna lead them, you know? And it's crazy to think that it took that long, right? It's to me, like, it's fascinating because video games are a young medium, but its games aren't made like movies are, where you literally can, like, shoot for about 8 months and then bing, bam, boom, you know, it's out the next year after post-production or something, right? Video, like, there is mm-hmm. a quote in Extra Lives, and this is actually really cool. It's Peter Molyneux, actually, who said that, you know, in movies and stuff, you just shoot and you can edit, recut. You normally have an excess of content, kind of like when we make YouTube videos. We generally have excess of content sometimes. And then you cut, you pare it down so that way it's the best version. But in video games, you literally have to build everything brick by brick. You have to build the physics. You have to build the world, literally. Then you have to build the characters. You need voice actors, motion capture, animation. You are literally building something from scratch, from like a blank slate, and then making sure that this is something that is, you know, fun at the end of the day. It's a truly, and this is words, it's a truly unprecedented media. There is nothing like video games out there where you literally build everything, you know, from scratch, which it's crazy to think about, right? Like, think about that.
Like in a movie, typically, like, yeah, you can build a set, but you can also like go to a warehouse and you could film it there or something. Like, you don't have to build the warehouse yourself.
Exactly. And also, like, you know, people might say, like, well, Alex, you know, Pixar makes films too and stuff, and that's all from scratch, right? I'm like, yeah, but you can also render a 3-hour Pixar film, squash it down to 90 minutes, and you have excess. You have that between that 90 minutes to 3 hours of footage that you can cut in from, insert into the movie. Video games don't have that. If a part of a game doesn't feel right, that level probably isn't even textured yet, or, you know, maybe it's partially textured. There was a famous story about 2 years ago that I personally thought was like really ridiculous, right? Where they had an entire favela area in BioShock Infinite completely done. Completely done, Daniel. And then they threw it away. Like, completely threw it away. Like, it's no longer part of the game. It was never part of the game anymore. Like, the whole... Because it didn't feel right. It didn't feel right. And, mind you, that is an excess, but that is millions of dollars down the drain. You cannot... Like, we're talking about a fully textured scripting and everything, Daniel. We're not even talking about, like, this, a small, like, oh, it's untextured still, they were just testing a concept. No, it was completely done. And imagine how many millions of dollars was spent because they had to throw that away. Like, man hours. Yeah. You know?
No, it also makes me feel like, wow, all that work.
Uh-huh.
All that work that those people put in, you know, texturing and modeling and, oh, man. And yeah. Just it never seeing the light of day. That hurts.
It's the equivalent, for the people who still can't grasp this idea, imagine building like a high-rise building only to realize that they actually didn't want the high-rise building there and you have to tear it down the following day and make it into a park. And you basically have to be the people to break it down and destroy it as well.
I just remembered, so the original Soul Reaver initially had a lot more content in it as well. But it had to be, like, substantially cut back and stripped down because the PS1 itself actually couldn't handle it.
Right, because it not only was it being made for PC, the PS1 had to be, you know, adhered to as well. And imagine the magnitudes of cost between the PS1 and the PS4, and the PS3 for that matter, when BioShock Infinite got made. Like, how many millions of dollars difference that is. You know, that's crazy. In the PS1 days, sure. Like, the graphics, you know, the way that it looks like and stuff, it's not high fidelity, it's not HD, but we're approaching 4K now. We're already at 4K now. And the next generation machines are going to natively output 4K. So the costs are just going to exponentially increase. And so now we're facing a situation where it's fun to, you know, enjoy games and stuff like that, but I think what's going to happen more and more in the future is that the people who make the games, you know, like not just the visionaries like Barlog and stuff, but also the people who are actually working on those are also going to hopefully get recognized as well in the future as, you know, putting their little signatures and stuff in the games that they're making. And I really think that 40 years from now, 50 years from now, I think what's going to happen is once we look back in games, we might not even see games that are critically acclaimed like God of War be, you know, part of the story, right? Like, maybe it'll be like, hell, it might even be BioShock Infinite, you know, as weird as that may sound. Or, heck, the original BioShock because of, you know.
I never played Infinite.
Well, you know, let's just use BioShock then as an example, you know, and actually, you know, look at that as an example of like how good video games were. Again, I'm just kind of throwing out these examples and stuff because, you know, back when we were playing NES games and stuff or Super Nintendo games, we never imagined the kind of high fidelity gaming that we're doing now, right?
Oh, no way. Yeah, like I still remember, I didn't grow up with the NES, but I did grow up with the SNES, and the idea that game, like if you told me when I was a little kid, that games, like you showed me a screenshot or something of what a current game looks like, you know, to like 8-year-old version of me, I'd be like, what the heck is that? I don't even know what I'm looking at. You know, like it's so far removed.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, the thing that's amazing about games these days is that, you know, a lot of people say like, oh, there's no originality in games anymore. And then you see these little tweaks, right? Like to the formula, like God of War, you know, like the simple fact that it's no longer a third person, like floating camera and they put it over the shoulder was such a huge change. And actually like a really good change that people didn't even think that would actually work, but it did, right? you know, a casual open world in Horizon Zero Dawn. People thought like, oh, Guerrilla Games, they're known for first person. They can't do an open world RPG, right? Wrong. It was actually the best-selling new IP for Sony. You know, and that's kind of like where I'm getting at here, is this video games are so unpredictable now, as they always have. And in fact, you know, because of the rise of indies and also rise of different platforms, right? Like mobile, the Switch, you know, like tablet gaming, like Facebook gaming. Heck, it's kind of crazy to even think about that was a thing. And there's so much more to, you know, to gaming and stuff. And I'm pretty sure like somebody's going to make like the next generation, like fucking Pokemon Go. God, I can't even believe the Pokemon Go is this generation. Think about that. That was not a thing before, but people play it. It's nuts. It blows my mind, like the way that we play games these days. So, anyways, speaking of which, I was actually going to use this as an opportunity to bounce off of this topic, because, you know, a lot of us have played a lot of mobile games that are like free to play, right? Have you played any free to play games, like mobile games before?
Hell nah, son.
Really? So you're
no
just
way.
So you're just this basically RPG dude that's gonna spend either 40 hours or none at all.
No, hey, come on. I play other games. I don't only play RPGs, but I typically do not play, you know, free to play games on my phone. At most I've played Sudoku on my phone.
Well, okay,
that's it.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. What is the most gamey game that you've ever played on your phone? Like an actual video game that you could say is an actual video game, not like a you know, gacha game.
Dragon Quest.
One. Really? Wow, that is a really real video game. That is literally... it's literally a port.
I love that. That's a really real game.
I mean, it's a straight up port, right? Like, it doesn't really... Like, to me, like, it doesn't really use the advantages of being in a mobile platform, like the touchscreen and all that stuff. It's literally, like, a virtual controller probably overlaid on top of an interface just to play an old game, right?
Pretty much,
I mean,
yeah.
That's what it is. That's not Mitch's words here. So,
yeah.
Okay.
It does have the added convenience of being able to save whenever you want, which is a godsend because, oh God, just thinking about having to like go back to the king every time you wanted to save.
Oh,
ooh.
Yeah. Oof. Yeah. I'm rolling my eyes over here because it's still a port. How about a non-ported game on the mobile? None?
Sudoku.
Really? Sudoku? Holy shit.
Let's see. I also played a game called 2048.
What's that? Oh, it's another fucking puzzle game. Okay.
Yeah, it's a puzzle game where basically you get these blocks and they're numbered 2 or 4, and then you combine them and then you get 8 and then 16, and you know, the numbers keep adding up, and then eventually you have to reach 2048.
Are you playing on an Android phone?
Yes.
That's why. It's pretty easy. Yeah, that's why.
Okay, what is that supposed to mean? Are you an iPhone snob or something?
I mean, it's not that I'm an iPhone snob. It's just that, you know, there's a lot more games, you know, and variants in the iPhone environment. And that's, it's not like you guys don't get it.
So you claim. However, I just don't care enough to fucking search for other games on my phone because I don't use my phone for that.
I mean, you say that, but, you know, unanimously and stuff, people make more money on the iPhone when it comes to games than Android. Sorry to tell
you. Okay.
That's reality. But also, like, it is a tendency for games to actually come out on iOS first, then Android later. You know, it is what it is. But what I was going to say was, like, there are some pretty decent, you know, free games on the iPhone, you know, I mean, and mobile in general, that whole platform and stuff. So, but generally speaking, the way that free-to-play games work, and, you know, I don't know if you're aware of this, but normally you get a finite amount of energy, to make moves, make actions in a game, you know, kind of like how Farmville was before, which is what that model was applied to mobile. And once you expend your energy, you could get more energy by either watching ads, right? Or spending money to buy more energy to do more actions, right? Which, you know, or you wait over time. So, like, after a minute, you probably get one energy, et cetera, et cetera. So, imagine my reaction when, you know, a lot of my friends were telling me about this awesome free-to-play game called Warframe. And I'm like, dear God, how much energy will I need in order to shoot my fucking weapon at somebody's face? Right? Imagine that model in a third-person shooter context. Wouldn't that sound ridiculous to you?
That, you know, that reminds me of this fucking, like, I don't know if this guy was, like, being recorded while he was, like, in a boardroom meeting or some shit. But, like, he was talking about trying to do, trying to make it so that reloading your gun in a game, you would have to, you would charge the players to do that. Like,
oh, yeah.
It was like the most evil shit I've ever heard.
I think he was just being facetious, but I know what you're talking about here. I think I remember that conversation.
But I don't know. It sounded like it was some boardroom meeting and the guy was being recorded and he didn't realize it. Oh. But I don't know. I could be wrong. It was I heard this recording like years ago.
I see. Yeah. I think you've mentioned that before too. So
because it's evil. It's evil as fuck.
It is. And, you know, we've talked about Warframe before in the perspective of watching, you know, Danny O'Dwyer's documentary on Warframe. And I talked a lot about it and stuff. And the last
that's a great documentary. That's what got me like interested in the game at all. And I haven't actually played it yet, but I did at least download and install it. So it's there. And, if, you know, I'll get to it.
It's
I'll
had a major it. Update since you last installed it, by the way. So there's
even
there's
better, that. Even better.
Yeah. So last time we talked about this game, I was kind of wishy-washy about it. I didn't really like it.
No, sir. You were not wishy-washy. You were, I did not like it. you were pretty much like, you were like, nah.
Yeah. So fast forward to this weekend, right? Like I looked at my time log and stuff and it said like, oh, you've spent about, you know, 50 minutes playing this game to today, which I looked and it's almost up to 10 hours. We're talking like, I'm probably like 10 to 15 minutes away from 10 hours. I know this and I'm keeping track of this because there is a trophy for people who have actually played Warframe for at least 10 hours.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this is what we call a paradigm shift.
Yes. So the interesting thing about this is that, you know, as with many people before me, you know, and of course me back several weeks and episodes ago, when we approached Warframe and stuff, it literally was very overwhelming. It's very daunting. In fact, it was so... You know, it was so overwhelming that, of course, at the time, I really hated the game. Like, I was never going to come back to it. And then something clicked in me, and I started thinking about, like, well, maybe I'm approaching this wrong. Maybe, you know, by thinking that this is a free-to-play game and stuff, that, you know, and looking so good that it is, I felt like that the developers still owed me the time to be able to, you know, properly explain how the game works. But I came to the realization that that's not their job anymore. In fact, even in the NoClip documentary, they've even said clearly that we've tried multiple iterations of how to onboard people and stuff, but the actual percentage of people actually staying never changed. You know, and that to me was a revelatory back then as it is now, that regardless of how smooth they made that ramp, it never led to people staying, right? And so I approached it in a fashion that, you know, I had understood part of the game and good enough of the game that I can continue. So now I had to figure out how do I progress through this game? Because there doesn't seem to be like a proper way to go about it. I was wrong. There's actually a way to go about it from a story perspective. And that's something that I discovered recently in my recent gameplay. So I went into the game again, trying to finish as many of the stories as I possibly could. And that's when I started finding how everything started working out. Like I started reading up a lot about like how to get new warframes, which, you know, if you played like MMOs or something like that, it's kind of like the equivalent of a class or a hero in a hero-based shooter like Overwatch. Weapons and stuff, how they're individually like, you know, like leveling and stuff. And, you know, I started learning and understanding what the gameplay loop was. And when I started understanding just the basics of, you know, the first three or four planets of the game, that's when an aha moment came to me. And I thought like, oh, wow, am I actually enjoying this game and understanding this game? Because hours would pass by and I would literally like lose time and I'd be like, oh, it's 8 o'clock. I need to make dinner situation, Daniel. And mind you, like, I'm still not 100% sure how everything works in Warframe. But what I learned was I learned enough about the game by, you know, studying it the way that I did that, you know, I actually started enjoying my time with it and the whole, you know, loot aspect of it, getting like, you know, like blueprints to make frames, to make new warframes and stuff, buying new weapons and slowly understanding how the ecosystem worked. And it's really fascinating to me how much I changed my opinion since that small 50 minutes that I spent all the way up until like 9 hours and 30 today. It's really, to me, it's really fascinating. And if you need a primer, like, and once you start playing, let me know, because once you start seeing that entire fucking UI and you're bombarded with a million things, like, you're gonna feel the same way I did months ago. But there is a way to, what's the proper word? Decipher through that and wade through all the junk, if you will.
Decipher.
It is though. It is though. It's weird to me because the feeling that I had trying to understand Warframe, and I think this is the reason why I went back to this game, it was the same feeling I had when I played Monster Hunter World, right? Like, for the longest time, I just couldn't understand why people like Monster Hunter, right? For the longest time, like, because I'm like, what's the appeal of this game? Like, what's the gameplay loop here? Like, why is this interesting? And then World happened, and I literally sat down and tried to understand why that game is so fun in general, right? And what the gameplay loop is, like how loot happens. And I applied that same kind of rigorous studying, in a way, to Warframe, and it's working out really well. Like, that same approach. And so I'm not saying that, you know, Warframe is equal to Monster Hunter World. That's not what I'm saying. But both games do demand that you learn from them and learn about them in order for you to truly understand how they play. Does that make sense?
Yes. The game kind of expects you to meet it halfway.
Yeah, exactly. And Monster Hunter has always been like that, I feel. Except for a World, which makes it a little bit easier. But certainly, you know, the kind of learning that I had to basically undertake in World was not as extreme as what happened in Warframe. And, you know, like I said, like, I feel like right after this show, the first thing that I'm going to pop into my PlayStation 4 is Warframe. That's literally...
Damn.
Yeah, that's literally what I'm going to do. And I'll tell you why. Everything is free in Warframe. Everything is free. The only things that a lot of people have told me that I should buy with the quote-unquote in-game currency, which is equivalent to cash, are Warframe slots, which will allow you to have more than one Warframe available to you to use, and weapon slots, which allows you to carry more weapons. I want to say there's about upwards to about a total of 200 or so Warframes and weapons in the game, cumulatively, like together. And you need slots for each of these, so makes a lot of sense. And trying to build those weapons and trying to build the warframes and collecting the crafting materials to make them is actually really addicting. I gotta be honest. You know, just literally playing the game is rewarding you for just playing it. It's kind of a crazy idea, right?
Like, just playing it rewards you.
I mean, it is. It's you know, you finish a level and you get crafting materials towards like either a new warframe or a weapon or some other thing, like a pet or a cosmetic or something. It's really crazy. And I think the way that I can summarize it is this, right? You know, back when I was playing Diablo 3 a lot, and I'm talking about the PS4 version here, I thought that the Mad Libs way of creating, you know, the variants in that game was really freaking fun. But the problem is that there wasn't a lot of sophistication involved and tied into that. I mean, it's still a sophisticated system, but I felt like I couldn't build the character that I want. Or I couldn't really... Like, there are ideal builds, right? Like, for example, in Diablo and stuff, it's like survivability versus output is always the priority. Like, meaning damage over armor. Like, I can't be like a tanky build too much, or, you know, I'm probably gonna die real quick. Whereas in Warframe, I feel like I have that freedom. I can build the character however I want. I can even assign any weapon that I want. I just need to be able to afford it and build it, right? And mind you, this is all happening in a free-to-play game. Free-to-play completely. And there are no elements of Warframe that are pay-to-win. The only things that you have to pay for are like pretty much cosmetics if you want to change the appearance of your Warframe. That's it, you know?
Which is interesting, because there was a time in this game's lifespan where it was pay to win, but the developers weren't malicious in that. They thought it would make the game more fun, and mm-hmm. then they realized, oh, wait a minute, no, this is actually kind of scummy, and they took it out.
They took it out, and they made those parts that you needed available as part of the missions in the game. And literally, this is why I say, like, in order to get some things in the game, like, you basically just play the game. And it's a weird phrase to think about, because, of course, you're going to play games to get rewarded. But more so in this, because it is free. I can't, you know, overstate that any more than I already have. You literally download the client on your PS4 or Xbox One or your PC, and you play. End of story. You pick one of the three characters, you play the game, you keep playing, the game is going to try to drip feed you info, and then when you get to the mod screen, you'll be completely overwhelmed, which, you know, it is what it is. But overall, you're playing the game. It's
for free.
For free. And to me, like, I think... And you know, I want to end at this, because I don't want to keep ranting about this, because I am really into the game.
Which is like such a stark difference from like the last few episodes ago when we spoke about it, and you were just like, bah.
Yeah, it totally is, right?
And now you're like, oh, I'm so into it. Okay, I'm gonna play it right when we're done.
I totally am. I'm not even joking. It is really rewarding. And you know, just to kind of, you know, tie this up a little bit and stuff, like, you know, the thing is, like, the conversation we had on Twitter keeps coming back to me, you know, after you know, talking about, like, free-to-play stuff. Like, there's that one time where I told you to download The Bureau from Humble Bundle because it's free. But even when I said that it was free, there was still a reluctance on your end to even pick it up. Regardless of whether or not you would have paid money to do it. Like, this is literally free. You were like, I don't know if I should get this. And I'm like, dude, it is free. What is so difficult about free? And, you know, I kind of come back to this whole PlayStation Plus thing, where a lot of people don't download all of the games on PlayStation Plus because they might not think that they'll pick it up later on and play it, right? Only to have them turn around towards you and say, hey, this copy of Yakuza 5 is only $30. This is cheap. Well, asshole, if you were a member of PlayStation Plus for the year that it was out, you would have gotten it for free. But okay, you can fucking get it for $30. It's the same concept here with Warframe, right? It's free, but there is a reluctance with people to actually try it. Maybe it's because of the mechanics. Maybe it's because, you know, free-to-play has tarnished our vision.
There's a stigma.
Exactly. And so, you know, I'm thinking actually about, like, making a video that would at least help people out if they do take a chance to download this game, at least on their PS4 or Xbox One or PC. Because It is overwhelming, but and again I'm writing this and I'm building this video only 10 hours in because I can only be a first timer one time in my entire life for this game. I can never be a first timer again once I've spent hundreds of hours on it, right? So I want to, you know, I want to build this video so that my mind is still fresh and I'm still new, so that I can kind of convey to other people, like, here's how to make Warframe manageable from like a beginner standpoint, because these are the kinds of questions that I asked when I started out the game, so that that way you're not going to run into the problem that I had many months ago where I fucking hated the game and now I've completely turned around on it, you know? So there's that. Oh boy. You are all quiet today.
Well, I mean, what do you want? I haven't played the game, so it's hard for me to say anything.
I mean, it's, you've played shooters before. I mean, it's I don't know. Like, you've watched the video, the documentary and stuff. Like,
I did, and the documentary was cool. But at the same time, I was also just interested in hearing what you had to say about it, because it's just so interesting to me that, like, you literally went from 0 to 100 of just like, I don't like this game, to like, yo,
but
this game is pretty fucking good. All right, guys.
And that's why, like, I tell people, you know, when people ask me about like turn-based strategy, why I hate it and stuff, and I always tell them, like, it's not that I dislike the genre, it's just that I haven't found
the right one,
right? Like, you know, it I feel like it's kind of the same with me in the Soul series, right? Like, and that's why I feel like, you know, I feel this way towards Bloodborne. That's why it's never left my PS4, right? Because one day I will spend so much time on that game that I will progress to a point and that something will click and I'll just completely just obliterate that game one day, you know, because, you know, it just takes me a little bit more time to understand it, but because I'm used to other games' conventions. But hey, I mean, hey, look, like, I finally beat Father Gascoigne this year. So, I mean, what, in about 30 years or something, I'll probably beat like the whole game or something like that. I'll be like, well, on my freaking
shit,
you know, Walker and shit, and be like, hey, I finally beat the game, guys. Finally beat it. Yeah.
It only took you, you know, 50 years, but you finally beat it. Yeah, good job, Grandpa.
Right. Yeah. I wouldn't.
Although,
I
to
wouldn't
be fair,
that
by that age, you probably wouldn't even have the reflexes to beat it.
It's not about the reflexes. It's not about the reads too. There was, man, I don't want to get into this now because we're kind of going over time. But I actually read this interesting study about how fighting game players aren't really, quote unquote, you know, like, reacting to things and stuff, like, I, you know what, I'm gonna leave it to another conversation some other time, but to kind of, you know, shorten it and stuff, basically, like, it was about this guy studying fighting game reactions, saying they're not actually reactions, they're reads. They are they're literally reading the other opponent and figuring out, like, what they're gonna do next, which, you know, I think that's, you know, in a way, like, Dark Souls and those Souls games kind of, you know, teach you in a way. So, yeah. Wow, there's so much conversation here just talking about, like, all these games. It's kind of crazy that we've ran this long, but I do want to ask
I felt like there was a few things that we should have discussed that we didn't, but, you know, yeah, we're babbling too much, so we should wrap it up.
we totally should. I don't know, I'm just excited about Warframe. I want to get back into playing it. Anyways, this week's community question is pretty damn simple, dude. I'm pretty sure you can tell me what it's what yours is gonna be, because this week's community question is, what is your favorite non-violent activity in games?
Interesting. My favorite non-violent activity is probably exploration.
Okay.
I just love exploring. I think it's partly why Shadow of the Colossus is one of my favorite games. I just love exploring the Forbidden Lands, to the point where one of my favorite channels is a channel called Nomad Colossus. And what he does is he actually finds ways to go out of the game's boundaries and he finds, like, you know, stuff that the developers left there that, you know, nobody was supposed to see. And he's found, like, all sorts of crazy stuff. Like, there's actually, like, a whole, like, dams, like a kind of, like, yeah, like a dam system that's, like, all floating in the void that no one is supposed to see. This, you know, complete, just, like, unused asset that, like, was probably meant to be used in, like, an earlier build of the game, but, like, for whatever reason, they dropped it.
Mm-hmm. So, wow. That's really nuts. That's really crazy.
Yeah, yeah. So, definitely exploration. I love just exploring games, and that's the thing that I liked most about Zelda Breath of the Wild, because, like, even though the combat's kind of meh, you know, and the loot system was kind of not counterintuitive, but rather kind of very defeatist in a way, because, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, the rewards in that game didn't feel as rewarding as, like, any of the other Zelda games, because the rewards aren't as tangible. That being said, the journey to those chests were usually really fun because you had this giant, beautiful world to explore. Just would have been better if the rewards were, you know, better, but whatever.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right on this. It's crazy.
Yeah, Darksiders 2 suffered from the same issue where, like, oh, I have this special ability that allows me to grab onto these little rings that I didn't before. I remember that from one of the earlier levels. Let me go back. It's a chest with boots that are of lower quality than the ones I have. Fuck you.
Wow. Great.
Yeah. Oh, man. Ugh. That's my biggest problem with loot systems. Just mm-hmm. just wasting your time, just, like, fiddling around with junk.
Well, hopefully, like, when you do play Warframe, you don't feel this way. It's, yeah.
No, Warframe has a loot system?
I mean, it's pretty much what it is, right? I mean, it's like, you know, like, you buy, instead of getting the actual gun and stuff that you need, you basically get the parts for the gun you want to build, right? And then, really, that's the big issue is, you know, trying to find, like, the crafting parts that you need. And that's all randomized, but it's free to play. Like, I could go, I mean, I don't want to go back into the whole Warframe thing. That's already crazy and crazy long and stuff. But I think exploration is one of my favorites and stuff. But if you guys are curious about what I picked as my favorite activity for, you know, or for non-violent video games or whatever and stuff, and non-violent in general, non-violent activity. Well, you see, I'm like totally rambling now. Go to youtube.com/mybacklogbattle. Community question releases every Monday at 8 a.m. Pacific time without fail. It's always really fun to see your responses there and, you know, to be able to talk to you guys about your responses. And, of course, you can check me out on that YouTube channel as well, where I'm going to be covering Yakuza and Final Fantasy 14, which I know I said Final Fantasy, but I think 14 is going to be my jam. And maybe Warframe, you know, at some point. So I think,
the new pillar of the channel, maybe.
I don't think I have like Final Fantasy 14 as a pillar yet, but it will be soon. So hopefully you guys should check that out over there. And of course, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/mybacklogbattle, and instagram.com/mybacklogbattle, because I started posting stuff there. So hopefully you guys, you know, enjoy some of the screenshots that I'm going to be sharing over there and stuff, because I think that's going to be pretty good, I think. So anyways, do you want to talk about where people can find you and what you're up to next, Daniel?
Sure. So you can follow me on Twitter at Shintai Reviews, and you can subscribe to my YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/Shintai Reviews. And I'm currently working on, because I finished the script, so I'm actually in the middle of editing my next video. I want to say that editing is about 25% done. And as of this recording, I intend for the video to be uploaded, you know, sometime during the week, probably on like Friday or something.
Cool, cool. That sounds really, really cool. And all yes. Right. Yep. All right.
I was going to say it is a video about an anime. However, I've specifically written it in a way that non-fans can enjoy. So if you've never seen or heard of the anime being discussed, don't worry about it. I made it for people like you to enjoy as well.
Awesome, awesome. All right, guys. Well, that about does it for this week's episode of the show. I'm going to be playing Warframe right now. So, but we'll see you guys next week. Remember, the podcast releases every Wednesday at 12 a.m. Pacific time. Hopefully, you guys enjoyed this episode. Remember to email us at podcast@mybacklogbattle.tv if you guys have any questions, comments, or suggestions for today's show. And until next week, we'll see you guys later. Happy gaming.
Happy gaming.